Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Even more dire news out of civil war-torn Syria this month. The United Nations World Food Program announced that it lacks the funding to provide aid for nearly 1.7 million refugees. Hungry children, hungry families, left hungrier as the weather turns cold. But the food crisis is not isolated to the Middle East. Regional and global conflicts worldwide have led to an unprecedented food need that just is not being met. This hour, On Point, food aid and the global hunger crisis. You can join us on air or online. Have you seen the pictures, the images out of Syria of people starving to death? Do you even know what the World Food Program does and what this funding gap means for millions of people? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Rome, Italy, is Abir Atifa, Middle East spokesperson for the World Food Program, which has halted food aid to Syrian refugees because the money has simply run out. Abir, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So what is the situation on the ground in Syria right now? I know you just returned from there.
In Syria, the situation is very difficult. Many of the families are displaced. Actually, half the population is displaced. It means that they have moved homes from one place to the other, and many of them have had to multiple times leave their homes and neighborhoods and go to another area or live with relatives. But it seems the circle of violence is always following people. Inside Syria, we're providing food assistance to over 4.2 million people, and our latest assessments, which was around maybe 6 or 7 months ago, have shown that actually half the population also in Syria is food insecure. Out of that, 6 million people are severely food insecure. What this means is that they do not know where their next meal is coming from.
And how might this change or get worse as winter arrives?
Winter is extremely difficult in many parts of Syria, especially the ones, the areas that border Iraq and Syria. They do survive in very cold weathers. The temperatures are quite extreme, very hot in the summer and extremely cold in the winter. And many of these families are living in unfinished homes and buildings and don't have the proper shelter, let alone, of course, the food that they will be that they can consume so that they use the calories that help these families, especially women and children and the elderly, fight off the cold.
So with half the population of Syria displaced, 6 million people living in situations where they find themselves food insecure, they don't know where the next meal is coming from. Talk about the role of the World Food Program, what you've been doing in Syria, and how this funding being cut will affect people in Syria.
WFP has been working inside Syria for, you know, since the beginning of the crisis and even before, but we've switched into very much emergency mode as of when the crisis started. We have so far reached over 4 million people. Many of them are in besieged areas or in very difficult to reach areas in the conflict zone, and many of them are just displaced in areas that have been deemed safer by people, and they have lived with neighbors or relatives or, you know, family members. Very difficult situation for the inside Syria. However, we also have a big emergency operation whereby we assist close to 2 million refugees who've crossed border into the neighboring countries. And this is where we had this month a very difficult situation in which we had to actually suspend our operation. In the neighboring countries, that's mainly Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, Turkey, and Iraq, we help the refugees through an electronic food voucher program. It's exactly like a debit card. And every month, the refugees will get money uploaded automatically from the World Food Program on this card, where they can go buy to the shops and groceries in the area. Mm-hmm. And redeem these cards against, you know, the food items that they need. It gives them choice, and it gives the families the ability to pick what the children like, and it does also help the local economies of the host communities. And many of them are as much poor as the refugees that they are hosting them. So through this electronic voucher program, we've pumped over $800 million in the local economies of these host communities, which also helps in making them more receptive to receive Syrian refugees.
So now, Abir, with your funding cut, 2 million refugees crossing the border, many more inside Syria itself, food insecure. Help us understand the scope of this. Are we talking about thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who could starve this winter if the World Food Program is not in place?
It's a very difficult situation, and I have just come from the some of these informal settlements in Lebanon, and I do worry a lot and think a lot. We all think about these families who are living in very difficult, circumstances, plastic sheets and living off mud. The weather conditions in these areas extremely cold. Mm-hmm. And when I was there last week, the families, they were running out of food because they have just used all the money on the card. And they said, in the beginning of the month, we will get what we need. I do worry and think about these families, and they were mainly women and children. Most of the men are either in Syria or they are old, and some of them are widows.
Women and children. Abir Atifa, Middle East correspondent for, spokesperson actually for the World Food Program. I really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us today from Rome. Let me bring in now from Washington, Howard LaFranchi, diplomacy correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. His most recent piece on the global food aid crisis, Why Are the World's Food Aid Programs Running Short of Money, lays out this problem in stark fashion. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Howard LaFranchi, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So we just heard Abir Atifa talking about an emergency mode within the World Food Program. They put out this appeal for emergency funding this week. How did this happen? How did they run out of money, a group that helps so many refugees around the world?
Well, I think there are two basic problems. One is that you do have this sort of confluence of a large number of crises. A couple of months ago, I did a story about how, for the first time since World War II, the world now has over 50 million refugees. So you have this problem. And on the other hand, an organization like the World Food Program, it doesn't have an annual budget. It depends on donations. And so there are annual appeals, and they get their pledges. But as we know, in so many cases of this sort of thing, countries, they love to go to these conferences, these donor conferences, and pledge and look good, but they don't always come through. And so my understanding is that the World Food Program is operating on about 40% of what it both what it said it needed and what was pledged. It's not a sudden problem, though. Take the Syrian case. The World Food Program, back in September, they already cut the rations about in half on these and cut levels on the debit cards that Abir was talking about. And they've taken other measures in other countries. In Kenya, they've refugees they're working with there. They've had to cut funding. So they've been preparing for this all the while, putting out appeals. But it was just this week that, again, as you announced, as you said, that the funds aren't there. So they've said they please come forward, those who have pledged. But so far, we haven't seen any big response.
And it's the refugees now who, either crossing the border or within Syria itself, are suffering greatly. We hear the stories of the World Food Program workers coming under fire as they deliver aid within Syria and beyond. What are the conditions associated with this work inside Syria?
Well, and indeed, that's another problem. If you think about what we might think of the traditional conflict, generally, whether it was a civil war, generally, the fighters on both sides, they would welcome the humanitarian intervention, or whether they were a UN agency or NGOs. to bring in food and other kind of assistance. But now, one of the features of so many conflicts, both in the case of Syria with the Islamic State, but in Africa more and more, we're seeing with Boko Haram, with Al-Shabaab, that these are organizations that they see this kind of intervention as, you know, outsiders, Western intervention, and so it's become very dangerous, actually, to do this kind of work in many places. And so, on top of just the sheer numbers of the refugees, the work has become more difficult. And in some cases, NGOs that did this kind of work have just had to pull out, you know, concerned about the safety of their workers.
Just given up. This refugee from Syria's northwestern province is angered that the UN will not provide or not be able to provide food for her and her son. Here's some sound interpreted by the PBS NewsHour.
This is unfair. The Syrians do not deserve this. We fled our country from the ongoing war and hunger and became refugees here. I have patience for one day without food, but my son cannot.
Can you put a number on this, Howard LaFranchi? I'm speak about the scope of this, the number of people affected by the cut to the World Food Aid program in Syria.
Well, we're told that this will actually have an impact on about 1.7 million Syrian refugees that are outside refugees. Therefore, they're in neighboring countries. I think, as Abir said, the largest numbers are Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, and then there are some in Egypt and Iraq as well. And the problem is that they're in most cases they're living in camps, so winter it's going to be very cold and. You know, they don't have sources of income. They can't go out and say, okay, well, I'm going to go to the field and, you know, gather food. They are completely dependent on these programs.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about the World Food Program running out of money to help feed the world's most vulnerable refugees in Syria and the impact around the world. Here's one Syrian refugee at a makeshift camp in Lebanon's Baqa Valley saying that the conditions in the camp are harsh, interpreted by the PBS NewsHour.
These tents don't keep us warm. Even when lit, the heaters don't keep us warm. I survive only thanks to the UN food vouchers. I don't get anything else.
You can join the conversation, listeners. Does the Syrian refugee crisis just not seem real to you, so far away? Syrians in the U.S., Syrian Americans, what needs to be done here? Who should step in? My guest this hour, Howard LaFranchi, diplomacy correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And now I'd like to add another voice to the conversation. Joining me from Tacoma, Washington, is Emily Piney, professor of international political economy at the University of Puget Sound. Her work focuses on global food systems. Professor Piney, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, so the Syria refugee crisis is ground zero right now with this cut in food aid. But places like Africa, regional sectarian conflicts have been heating up really all over the world. A lot of hot spots right now. Is the World Food Program simply stretched too thin? Emily, what's at the heart of this to your mind?
Well, Jane, this isn't really a new problem. As Howard mentioned earlier, the World Food Program has been struggling to meet its benchmarks for several months now, but this isn't even a new problem in 2014. The World Food Program repeatedly comes up against these funding shortfalls, and in my mind, part of the reason for that is the way that the U.S., which is the largest single donor to the World Food Program, gives aid.
And how do they give aid?
Well, the U.S. is one of the last countries in the world to give significant in-kind aid to the World Food Program as opposed to just giving cash donations. Mm-hmm. So basically, the U.S. government buys agricultural commodities from U.S. farmers, packages them in the U.S., and ships them overseas on U.S. flagship vessels, which is sort of internationally recognized to be a very inefficient way of giving aid to the World Food Program. And because of reforms recently implemented by the Obama administration, the proportion of in-kind aid is shrinking, but Most other countries have shifted over to giving predominantly cash donations because those cash donations allow the World Food Program to be much more flexible.
Right.
Using vouchers.
That voucher program is the key here because they've changed the way the WFP does things. Traditionally, you know, the big truck backing in with, you know, porridge and big bags of rice and handing out food that way has been disrupted by this voucher program, which has been fairly effective, has it not?
Yeah, it actually has been very effective. And a lot of people argue that the U.S. should move towards eliminating the monetization of food aid and switching over to cash donations like most other countries have done. And that might help fill that funding gap.
And so with the voucher program, refugees then go to local markets if they are nearby, purchase food they want with these vouchers, prepare it the way they want. I mean, I've heard it called dignity food, right? It's quite important.
Absolutely. And the benefit of that is both that it gives the refugees that choice that you're mentioning, but it also stimulates local markets, and it does the opposite of what decades of food aid from the U.S. have been doing, which is undercutting local farmers, undercutting local agricultural markets, and basically making it impossible for local farmers to compete with this free and subsidized food that's been flooding in from the U.S.
I want to get more sound in here. Here's a Syrian man from Damascus, from a suburb of Damascus, put a series of videos on YouTube begging for the siege to be broken there. He got out of Syria, but in an interview with CBS's 60 Minutes, he spoke about what he'd seen. Here he is with Scott Pelley.
Even while the regime is bombing, nobody cared. It seems like if you die from the shelling, it will be a merciful way to die instead of dying from hunger, because it will take months to die from hunger. People lost faith with the world, with their families, even with God. Nobody understood that we can die from hunger in the 21st century, in Syria.
The regime shelled Modamiya to rubble, used nerve gas on the population, but it was starvation.
Yes.
That broke the town.
That's absolutely true. It can destroy your soul, your mind, your beliefs, before it can destroy your body. Nobody in this world, no matter who he is, deserves to die from hunger. Nobody.
Emily Piney, speak about that, how starvation has been used as a weapon in the Syrian civil war. This man saying the town's been shelled to rubble, nerve gas used on the people, but it was starvation that broke us.
Wow, yeah, that was an incredibly powerful clip. That is a reality that is increasingly facing these record numbers of refugees that Howard cited earlier in the program. And the truth is that, you know, in 2008, we had a massive food price spike that happened around the world and that contributed to the Arab Spring. It contributed to sparking revolutions around the world because all of a sudden, literally overnight, people in Egypt and Tunisia couldn't afford the price of a loaf of bread. And this is a reality that we're facing. Every year, the UN comes out with estimates of a new food crisis that's looming on the horizon. And the fact is, it's not a problem of production. We're producing more than enough food to feed everyone in the world 2,700 calories a day. The problem is getting the food where it needs to be. The problem is the sort of systemic undercutting of local agricultural markets that's been happening for the last several decades. And so these are all large-scale problems that we need to be addressing. But in the immediate term, it's clear that these voucher programs that the World Food Program is promoting and is using in these areas are incredibly important for addressing this immediate problem.
Let's get some callers in here. Madison, Wisconsin is where Jeff is. Welcome to On Point. Jeff, nice to have you.
Yes. Hi, Jane. It's just another comment to second what your first guest noted about security conditions facing WFP staff themselves and their local partner agencies. I was a humanitarian relief worker in Africa in the 80s and never even thought about security risks. Relief work was a shield. Today it's a target. And I've worked with WFP on and off since 93. In emergency operations training for its staff, and the training used to focus solely on improving programming of food assistance. Well, today, any training with its field staff inevitably includes security risk management training, how to stay alive, basically. WFP, I just wanted to really underscore, does great work. Its field staff are extremely committed. They put their lives on the line, and our U.S. government has long been a really good big supporter of WFP, and it's I think it's a real feather in its cap, our cap. So it's just a plea that we shouldn't stop that support at this point, and should you know, support WFP in every way.
Yeah, Jeff, I'm curious. You've done this. You've been doing it since 1990, many years now. Aid workers, you said, were once shielded. Now they're targets. What's changed, do you think, over the last 10, 15 years?
Well, relief agencies are sources of assets. They have cars. They have houses. They have computers. They have other things which are necessary to undertake an operation. And people with guns just perhaps don't care anymore. In fact, today, in many operations, there are more humanitarian relief workers being killed than peacekeepers who are there to keep forces apart. It's just been an astounding increase. I was trying to come up with the figures, but I couldn't before the show when I heard about it. But I believe from 2012, when figures were already high, to 2013, there was something like a 66% increase, and this is, and these are increases way, way, way above anything that happened even 10, 15 years ago.
I'm so glad you called, Jeff. Thank you. Thank you very much. Emily Piney, you worry that what grabs attention or headlines in this crisis is that it's a refugee crisis, not a hunger crisis. Tell us how hunger underlies so many other political crises in the world.
Well, Jane, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the food crisis in 2008 and then the repeat of the food crisis in 2010 played a really big role in the Arab Spring. And I think we see this increasingly happening around the world. And, you know, the fact is that in the U.S., at least, this is the time of year around Thanksgiving and Christmas when people start thinking about, you know, we see food drives, we see people volunteering at food banks in the United States. The fact is we do have chronic hunger in this country as well. And the problem, I think, is that it is a chronic issue. It spikes at certain times and it grabs headlines in certain moments. But the fact is that it's a chronic problem that falls off of the radar of people in the U.S. and Europe, I think, when we're not sort of at the time of year that we're thinking about these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And it's not a problem that's going to go away anytime soon until we really address the ways that the food system is fundamentally broken.
Caller Jeff made me think of this clip with the head of the World Food Program. Their mission in Syria, Matthew Hollingsworth, speaking with 60 Minutes. Here he is describing coming into the city of Homs as an aid worker and then immediately coming under mortar fire.
It's panic, chaos, people screaming, people running everywhere, hot metal flying around you. You decided to stay, and I wonder why. We'd seen the faces of the people who were asking us to help them, asking the United Nations to help them in their time of crisis, which is why we're here. So we again negotiated with all the sides to this time obey the ceasefire, to respect the ceasefire. We went in the following day, and the next day, and the next day, and the rest is history.
Go back to the phones. Robert in Clarksville, Tennessee. Hi, Robert. Glad you called. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Yes, I have a question for your guest today. And maybe I'm oversimplifying a complex situation, but I've noticed, though, that, you know, as I understand, as, you know, members of a world community, we have a certain responsibility to other members of the community. But my question is, and yes, I admit I'm speaking from a certain bit of ignorance, though, is that I see a little bit of blame seem to be put on the world as a whole as why they're not helping, but I kind of question why it seems like maybe why is not any responsibility being put on these governments that, you know, failed their people, that caused these refugees, that caused this situation?
Robert, thank you. Howard LaFranchi, let me come back to you, diplomacy correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Beyond the United States, what about other governments stepping in here, jumping in to help, to fund programs like the World Food Program that helps these refugees?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think the caller was referring specifically to the governments of the countries where these crises are taking taking place, and you know, no one is letting them off the hook. But of course, in the case of Syria, you know, the United States is on record. You know, we want that government out, the government of Assad. So we're not really counting on them, and they're the ones that are also, you know, using starvation as a tool of war.
Right, but
so
what about bordering
really,
countries like Jordan
right,
and
really
Egypt and Lebanon?
Count on them. And yes, and then those countries, I don't think anyone can, as we've heard, you know, all Jordan and Turkey and Lebanon have taken in what amounts to millions of refugees. And these are strains on them. And I understand the caller, but you know, for the United States, you know, you have to think about you know, when there is you know, insecurity and upheaval and instability in these regions, it ends up if you look at it purely from a self-interested perspective, it ends up coming back on us. So we do have an interest in addressing these. In these crises, now the United States is the largest single donor. Mm-hmm. I think there's no questioning that. There, you know, you can criticize you know, the way our aid is provided, but the U.S. is the largest single provider. Provides also, you know, a good amount of cash. And I think we heard after this announcement came out from the World Food Program suspending the aid to Syrian refugees, you know, USAID came out with a statement and said, you know, we're very concerned about this. But you know, they noted that the U.S. had just donated $125 million the week before. That was really to cover the month of November, pretty much of the voucher cards, and really there was a plea there to, you know, to other countries. I mean, there are a number of large, you know, wealthy countries again that have made pledges
that haven't followed through
at the beginning of the year, but they have not followed through.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Let me go back to Matt in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Matt. Thanks for calling. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I was just calling to see if your guest could touch on world population and controlling it for human beings and how that's related to this subject, because I know some of the fastest growing countries in the world are in Africa and other impoverished areas, and I just thought it might be a good idea to spread that kind of word there. You know, religious leaders don't seem to do it. Politicians don't seem to do it. And even if there's enough food to go around the world, should we be using that much food? Is it sustainable to have, 6.5 billion people now? Or I might be off with that.
But. No, Matt, thank you. I'm glad you called. Emily Piney, what about the massive world population as the world grows? Is this something that plays into the calculus?
Well, I mean, we do hear sort of alarming reports coming out of the United Nations every few years saying that we're going to have to double our food production by 2050 if we're going to feed the growing world's population. But I think that focusing on population growth takes attention away from the real issue, which to me really is the kinds of food that we subsidize and the way that that food gets distributed around the world. And some real weaknesses in both our infrastructure in the U.S., Canada, and other large producing countries like Brazil and Argentina, but also issues of economic inequality and poverty. Because economic inequality, poverty, and conflict are really at the heart of these issues, much more so than a simple numbers game of population versus production.
Howard LaFranchi, do you agree?
Well, yes, but you know, I would also point out that economic development. You know, if the focus is on economic development, that really is an answer. I mean, you look at a country like China with over a billion people pulling hundreds of millions out of poverty, and countries in Africa that were, you know, on the road to growth, they were stable. And in the case of West African countries, you know, Ebola comes along and it throws off the growth that they were experiencing. So I think, yes, long term, maybe population a problem, but the solutions really are elsewhere, and things like focusing on economic development.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the World Food Program's announcement that it is suspending food aid for up to 1.7 million displaced Syrian refugees and the charity challenge as we move into winter. Here's a 12-year-old boy, Syrian boy, in a refugee camp in Jordan last year, speaking to Reuters about being hungry.
In the last 3 weeks in Syria, we were living on bulgur, tomatoes, and sometimes there was a car that brought bread, but it was very expensive. What can I say? The situation was dark and difficult. When there was no food, my siblings got very hungry, and they would come to me or to my mom and say, "Mom, we are hungry. We want food."
You can join the conversation, listeners. Does the United States have donor fatigue here? Should other countries be stepping up more? I'm joined from Washington by Howard LaFranchi, diplomacy correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and from Tacoma, Washington, Emily Piney, professor of international political economy at the University of Puget Sound. And now I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining me from Amman, Jordan, is Andy Baker, regional program manager for the Syria Crisis Response at Oxfam International. Andy Baker, so nice to have you. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Jane.
Andy, what are you experiencing on the ground right now?
Well, this announcement of cuts to food vouchers has really come as a big surprise to all of us, and most of all to the refugee populations who rely on this income for their basic food needs. There's a very real immediate risk of families going hungry in the very short term.
Can you talk about that more broadly speaking? You see children and mothers and whole families coming in with just the clothes on their backs. I mean, it's a dire circumstance, is it not?
Well, yes. I think different refugees have arrived with different amounts of goods and assets, but a lot of them have been in Jordan and in Lebanon and in other countries for such a long time that they've depleted all of those assets they brought with them. I see refugees around, and I rarely see refugee women wearing their wedding rings now because most people have sold the assets they bought with them. So they've got nothing to fall back on in terms of alternatives when this income source has been cut almost with no notice at all.
At Oxfam International, you build and maintain refugee camps. You provide water and hygiene facilities. What is the biggest need on the ground? Is it simply food?
When we're out talking to refugee groups, that is always the number one thing they want to talk about, is the access to money to be able to buy food and meet the other basic needs. Healthcare is another priority that's often raised. Here in Jordan, the government has very generously provided free healthcare to refugees, but last week announced that that was now over and the refugees would have to pay their way. So another big shock to family finances.
Your work also includes promoting a global public awareness of the crisis in Syria and in the region. Does the world truly understand, do you think, the crisis happening now inside Syria as it relates to food insecurity and truly starvation?
I think that the way the world's media works is that stories are new and they get coverage, and then the story gets a bit old and tired and it doesn't get coverage anymore. And sadly, that's where the Syria crisis seems to be, that people have got used to this story and they've moved on in their minds to other things. And yet this remains by far and away the biggest crisis the world is facing, the biggest refugee crisis since the Second World War, enormous numbers of people in desperate need.
Mm. Andy Baker, Oxfam International Regional Program Manager. Stick with us. Let's go back to the phones here. Roger is in Austin, Texas. Hi, Roger. Glad you waited. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks. Hi, Jan. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure.
I work with a drone company here in the States called 3D Robotics, a UAV company, and we sponsor a nonprofit startup called the Syria Airlift. And the Syria Airlift aims to deliver small packets of humanitarian aid by a large number of, tiny drones, sort of crowdsourcing a humanitarian delivery effort to Syria, because you can't do airdrops there. You know, airdrops require a combat operation to protect the cargo planes. Mm-hmm. And so in a nuanced and complex, conflict zone like Syria, I was wondering if this could be, sort of the future of humanitarian aid delivery, not with like a traditional large organization like the UN, which would require a lot of infrastructure and manpower, but with, smaller and more nimble private localized efforts like this that would be empowered by cheap and powerful technology, sort of like the long tail of humanitarian aid delivery. Mm.
It's so interesting, Roger. Thanks for calling. Tell me how you use crowdsourcing and these tiny drones to deliver the food.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the drones are they're really cheap. They're like, you can make them out of Dollar Tree foam. They cost less than $500, and you have an autopilot in them, and you can program the autopilot to fly, one way, and the autopilot will self-destruct, so, a hostile actor can't get its hands on the electronics. And they can be assembled in Turkey. I mean, this is going on right now. Refugee camps can take part in that. It would empower, a local organization, and it costs very little. It can deliver medicine and, small packets of food or, water or vitamins across the border. And they would, but it has to be cleared, of course. There's lots of, lots of conflicts with Turkey and U.S. airspace and all
sure.
that. But it's a viable project, and it seems to show promise.
So glad you called, Roger. Thank you very much. Emily Piney, what about these smaller, more nimble organizations, little tiny drones, crowdsourcing, that are disrupting traditional aid delivery? Do you see that as the future?
It's possible. I do think that the World Food Program has a really important role to play and probably will continue to play that role for quite some time to come. But I do think that it's interesting that the World Food Program itself is even turning to social media campaigns and other kinds of crowdsourcing efforts in order to raise money. I noticed their campaign to try to raise $1 from 64 million people, which is a really powerful tool. On the other hand, that's the budget that it would take to cover the vouchers for just the month of December in Syria. So I think that probably a partnership between smaller organizations and the bigger groups that have the infrastructure in place to deliver aid is probably really promising. Mm.
Andy Baker, would you welcome at Oxfam International a company like Rogers? Would you welcome that kind of disruption on the ground? Would that help you or would it hinder you?
I think that one of the challenges is about funding, and another one is about access. And there's lots of places inside Syria that are very, very difficult for aid actors to get to and to deliver aid goods. So anything that can be come up with as an alternative is certainly worth looking at. I think there would be some questions and challenges about how you would check where your products were ending up, how you would verify who was ending up with them and able to use them. But that's always a problem with any delivery of aid. How do you ensure it doesn't get diverted to be used by armed groups instead of by the most vulnerable people? Mm. But certainly I think this is worth exploring.
Roger, thanks so much for calling. Here's Steve in Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. Welcome to On Point.
Jane, whenever you have a multi-million dollar voucher program, fraud inevitably follows, such as food stamp fraud in the U.S. Question, has there been any evidence of food voucher fraud in refugee camps, say in Jordan, for example?
Steve, thank you. Howard LaFranchi.
well, of course, in any, we're talking about millions of dollars, and whether or not some of the money ends up in the wrong place, whether it's that can certainly happen. But the point is, just as with food stamps, that the vast majority, it's an efficient system. It not only does it help the family, but it's also, it's important to the host country, and so it's really much more efficient than the past sort of conventional mm-hmm. Program of delivering just large amounts of money. So, can there be problems? Yes, but for the vast majority of families, I mean, it's a very efficient program and a means of, you know, as somebody from the World Program said after this announcement was made about suspending funds, you know, the beauty of this kind of thing is that, you know, these families, they have the card in their hands. And so, you know, if donations come in, those can be replenished basically overnight.
Right.
Yes.
Here's Eric in Montreal, Canada. Hi, Eric. Welcome to On Point.
Yes. Hi, Jane. I just wanted to mention that in India, there are farmers that are committing suicide. They can't feed their families. They can't, produce enough food for the local communities. And in Mexico, you have that phenomenon as well. And I wonder if this is tied somehow to the big multinational corporations like Monsanto, which monopolize production in these third world countries and make food insecurity even a greater problem than it is.
Mm. Eric, thank you. Emily Piney, what do you think?
Well, I mean, as I mentioned before, I think that the sort of history of the way that food aid has been delivered in the world has definitely contributed to undermining agricultural productivity in a lot of countries that are recipients of aid. And as I mentioned before, also the sort of structure of the global food system is such that we subsidize very specific kinds of agricultural commodities very heavily in certain parts of the world, and then give them away for free or sell them at below cost to countries that are struggling. And that, in the sense that it meets an immediate humanitarian aid, that's great. But as I said before, the long term consequences of that are that small scale farmers in a lot of these aid recipient countries can't compete. And so I think part of what we really need to think about is to see our small-scale farmers and to see the countryside as a source of resilience and as a source of sort of a buffer between hunger and the local population, and to really use our development dollars to support the reconstruction and the rebuilding of that small-scale agricultural system.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Andy Baker from Oxfam International, Howard Franke from the Christian Science Monitor said earlier in the program that often there's not enough follow-through on pledge money from foreign countries, that the World Food Program is operating on about 40% of what it's pledged to them. Really a hand-to-mouth operation at this point. Is there any way, to your mind, you're there on the ground, any way to prevent these big funding gaps from bubbling up?
Well, I think this is about how we all apply pressures to the governments of the world to step up and pay their fair shares. If we look at the need of the whole Syria crisis in Syria and its surrounding countries and the enormous amount of money that's needed month by month, and then look at who's paying for that, we find that the host countries, Lebanon and Jordan and Turkey, are paying way more than their fair share. And some of the Gulf countries have stepped up too and are paying an awful lot, like Kuwait and Qatar. But we find other countries in the world who are not paying anything like a fair share when you look at the size of their economy. I would cite particularly Russia, Australia, Austria, Spain, who really haven't contributed anything like what they should be contributing in relation to the size of their national economies.
Mm. Wafa is in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Wafa. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to add a comment about the Gulf oil-rich countries, what they are donating, and if they are doing enough of their share. And just mentioned that my daughter, who's in high school, participated in the Summer Institute of Buffalo, and it was all like, small community efforts. Mm. They raised enough money to buy a prefab house for a refugee family in Jordan. And they didn't have to go through any security problems or anything. So why can't food be provided to the secure areas of Lebanon and Jordan and Turkey?
Mm. Emily Piney, why not?
I think that, again, as our guests who are on the ground have mentioned, that even these secure areas are surrounded by conflict. And I think that it's just the access is just really difficult.
Here's Jill in Weston, Massachusetts. Hi, Jill. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My comment is I see that, countries and people with money can put money into politics and wars and weapons, and I really think that they need to focus on putting that money into food security and healthcare and infrastructure building so that people in these countries that are war-torn are less reliant on extremists and terrorists.
Okay, Jill, thank you. I'm glad you called, wrapping us up here. I just would put this on the table that the World Food Program started in the Eisenhower administration. It's had a long history, you know, thousands of people, 14,000 volunteers, I think, worldwide. Howard LaFranchi, tell me how you think or what you think the main concern, the biggest concern is for global food charities such as WFP, who has cut this funding. What's their biggest challenge moving forward? Is it just raising the money? Is it just getting the word out? What is it?
Yeah, I think maybe long term. Somehow we have to think about a different way of funding. You know, from these donor conferences and pledging, everybody ruffles their feathers and looks really great when they pledge the amounts, but then when it comes down to it, the money doesn't appear. I mean, even USAID pointed out that. That they are getting by on a continuing resolution. You know, the United States doesn't have a budget, so USAID, you know, pointed out, you know, we're doing what we can, kind of month to month as well. So I think long term, maybe that has to be thought about. You know, and I think for Americans that that are thinking, if there is, you mentioned earlier, donor fatigue. But, you know, the King of Jordan makes the point that if the United States had the same number of refugees as Jordan is really welcoming, that the United States would have 60 million refugees in its border. So that's something to think about as we, you know, if we are tempted to think, ugh, tired of this. We've done enough and sort of close off.
Yeah. Andy Baker, in 10 seconds here, are you optimistic on the ground there in Amman, Jordan? You're going to get what you need to feed these people?
I'm very worried. And I think that what we see today will be repeated in a month from now and a month after that. I'm really worried that we need to push the world's government to step up and contribute more.
Andy Baker, Oxfam International, Emily Piney, international political economist at University of Puget Sound, and Howard Franchi, diplomacy correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you all very much for shedding light on this issue. Listeners, if you'd like to help, you can go to our website, find all the information there. Thanks for being with us, and thanks for your comments. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.